There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, and protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium. There's yttrium, ytterbium, actinium, rubidium, and boron, gadolinium, niobium, iridium, and strontium, and silicon, and silver, and samarium, and bismuth, bromine, lithium, beryllium, and barium. There's holmium, and helium, and hafnium, and erbium, and phosphorus, and francium, and fluorine, and terbium, and manganese, and mercury, molybdenum, magnesium, dysprosium, and scandium, and cerium, and cesium, and lead, praseodymium, and platinum, plutonium, palladium, promethium, potassium, polonium, and tantalum, technetium, titanium, tellurium, and cadmium, and calcium, and chromium, and curium. There's sulfur, californium, and fermium, berkelium, and also mendelevium, einsteinium, nobelium, and argon, krypton, neon, radon, xenon, zinc, and rhodium, and chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin, and sodium.
Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke. It is time for the Roundtable panel. Joe's on vacation for a few days this week. The music this morning, Tom Lehrer, the late satirist and scientist and mathematician, died over the weekend. He was 97. He was a leader of counterculture and satire. We will be listening to some of his less dark and murdery songs this morning.
Yeah.
Some of them are. That's part of it. I know that that's part of the oeuvre and something celebrated and funny, but I didn't feel like poisoning pigeons today with the music. So we're going to listen to a few of his songs that aren't, like I said, murdery. But
he's in the grand
Tom
tradition
Lehrer,
of murdery mathematicians.
The panel this morning, Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy, Bill Hammond. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Sarah.
Albany Law School Professor and Director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson. Hi, Sarah.
Good morning.
And former Times Union Associate Editor, Mike Spain. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Good morning.
Did you want to comment or add any knowledge on the late Tom Lehrer?
The late Tom Lehrer. I was just saying, as we were listening to the Pirates of Penzance, with different lyrics,
yes,
of course.
All the elements from the periodic table.
That I kind of knew who he was, but I hadn't really appreciated him until I read some of the appreciation stories and the obituaries after he passed over the weekend. And he was really talented. And Bill was pointing out that he left it all, walked away from it, and went back to the classroom and taught math, right?
At the peak of his fame.
Yeah. Yeah,
he was on all the TV shows and radio, and yeah, he was, it was before my time, but he was, like, his legend lived on, and so I was vaguely familiar with his music growing up and continued to hear it over the years.
Kind of like a Smother Brother, you know?
Yeah. Kind of like a Smother Brother, inspired Weird Al. He was a hero to Weird Al Yankovic. And Daniel Radcliffe performed that song that we just heard, the Elements song, on a talk show. And that's how he got cast as Weird Al in the mock biopic of Weird Al Yankovic, which is hilarious.
That's quite an audition.
It is indeed. Sarah, do you have any knowledge of Tom Lehrer, or is it not one of your guys?
No, I know. And
that's
math,
allowed.
Math is not my forte. That's why I'm a lawyer.
Well, Tom Lehrer, a satirical leader from the Cold War era, essentially passed away over the weekend. He was 97, and we will be listening to his music this morning. The playlist is posted online at wamc.org/roundtable. You can join our conversation about the news of the day by emailing panel@wamc.org. Please do keep your letters short, to the point, and on topic, and free of expletives, if you would. We can speak around them, but it's better not to, you know, see them in print and be tempted. Don't include links or attachments, and don't use obscure abbreviations. Please proofread your emails before you send. Again, I list these rules. They're very lightly, if at all, enforced. Yes, loose guidelines. panel@wamc.org is the email address. Are you guys ready to jump into these many stories we have?
Your rules are a lot like the tariffs agreements.
Oh, don't say that.
Except they actually exist on paper.
in a way. Let us discuss news out of Manhattan last night. A gunman opened fire inside a Midtown Manhattan office building. This coverage from The Gothamist. On Monday evening, killing four people, including a New York Police Department officer who was off duty but working a paid gig as security before killing himself. City officials said a fifth victim was critically injured. In a late-night press conference, police officials described the shooting, which shut down several blocks of Midtown Manhattan during Monday's evening rush hour. They said the gunman acted alone, and in this coverage it says a motive was not yet clear, but Mayor Eric Adams of New York City was just on saying that they think the shooter had a traumatic brain injury caused by football and blamed the NFL for this. I don't think that is proven, but it was something the mayor of New York was just saying on the air. New York Police Department Commissioner Jessica Tisch said the shooter opened fire inside 345 Park Ave, a commercial building that houses firms including Blackstone, KPMG, the NFL, the National Football League, and Rudin Management. The gunman double parked BMW on Park Avenue, carrying an M4 rifle. Surveillance footage showed him entering the building and immediately shooting the police officer in the lobby. The gunman then fatally shot a woman taking cover behind a pillar, fired into the lobby and shot a security guard, then called an elevator, allowed a woman to walk past him unharmed, and rode to the 33rd floor, home to Rudin Management, where he fatally shot another victim before shooting himself. An act of gun violence, you know, akin to things we've seen before. I don't know what a radio discussion can necessarily add, but it is a huge story. And we, of course, offer our, you know, condolences to everybody who's suffering and scared from any violence like this. Sarah?
Yeah, there are a couple of things that I'm noticing out of this particular story. One is I saw in another in other coverage on the shooting, which I was reading late into last night, that there were a number of security measures in place in the building. And the problem is that many of those security measures hinged on one of the people that was victimized in the attack. And you see that over and over and over again. You know, the rhetoric of it takes a good guy with a gun to stop a bad guy with a gun doesn't work if they have different guns. And I'm not suggesting that our police forces be armed with weapons of war, right? It's not an issue of matching forces. It's an issue of what really keeps people safe. And it sounds like from very preliminary reports that this person, you know, came from far away, Nevada,
drove from Nevada.
May or may not be a state that has a red flag law like we do in New York, which is a law that goes to a certain degree to really protect people from themselves in a lot of cases. But threat assessment, right? That's what law enforcement has been saying for decades and decades and decades. It started with the CIA and the FBI. They meet at Disneyland in Florida, which seems like, or Disney World. Which one is it?
It's Disney World in Florida, if it's in Florida.
Yeah.
Sure.
So, you know, these threat assessment teams that are now sort of popping up everywhere are really, really important, and they need to be multidisciplinary and they need to have legal structures around them. But no amount of security is going to keep us safe from these types of attacks. And then, you know, I'm also noticing that, again, one of the first victims is a police officer, and first responders are indeed like some of the, you know, most likely victims of mass shooting events, especially when domestic violence is involved, or I guess I should say community violence when firearms are involved, because first responders and police officers are often first on the scene in a domestic violence incident. And we know if a firearm is present, the likelihood of a fatality is greatly increased. So that's why we have other laws, like the Supreme Court has recently stood by its decision to keep firearms out of the hands of those convicted of domestic violence in order to reduce those incidents. These, of course, are not the conversations we'll hear over the next couple of weeks, but those are the two points that stick out to me as I dig into this issue more.
Bill?
One thing we will be hearing about probably is the fact that the officer who lost his life, whose name I haven't committed to memory yet, but he was an immigrant. He was himself born in Bangladesh, I believe.
Yep.
Yes.
And when a police officer dies anywhere, but especially in New York City, it becomes kind of a moment. It's almost like a religious ceremony in New York City, where there's a lot of solemnity. There's a huge funeral. The officers line up in their dress uniforms, forming kind of a cordon as the hearse comes down. All of the elected officials, all of the candidates for office. It's a command performance. You have to be there. And the person who will be at the center of that will be an immigrant at this moment where immigrants are kind of a hot topic in our politics and they're coming under all kinds of pressure from the federal government. And so politicians of all persuasions are going to feel the need to say nice things about this late officer. And there's something very poignant about that he... He tragically lost his life. He's got three kids and another one on the way.
Two and one third on the way.
Yeah.
Did a rule Islam, a 36-year-old immigrant.
Yeah. I think the NYPD in our politics kind of codes as right and codes as white males and maybe Irish. And they have evolved quite a lot. Even in my lifetime, where they are now, they do have a substantial number of officers who are not white, who are not male. And this is it's a very random event, but the random event happened to land on a guy who embodies kind of the new face of the NYPD. So it's a powerful symbol, I think. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Sounds like he was moonlighting, too. So you have to wonder if the NYPD's collective bargaining agreement is really working out for a lot of its members if somebody's working two jobs in order to make ends.
Well, he had a young family, growing family, and it demonstrates he's been a police officer about 3 years, and it demonstrates to me, I mean, perhaps you're right, Sarah, but about the wages and the difficulty and the cost of living in New York City. But it shows he was working hard, making extra money, wearing the uniform of the New York PD, which they're allowed to do when they're paid as private security. And this building was where he was working, unfortunately, yesterday. And you both make such excellent points. And clearly he had left a note, and the note included that he was suffering from the traumatic brain injury that. The shooter believed that happened playing football in high school, and he had a vengeance against the NFL for hiding the impact of it, and it just shows how he was able to still obtain and he was licensed in Nevada, an AR-15 style rifle. Which is an assault weapon. I think you put it as a weapon of war, which I completely agree with, Sarah. And he was able to, you can have security in a building, but when someone walks in with a weapon of war, you can't match that. And that's what happened. And evidently it was a seriously injured or critically injured in this shooting incident was an employee of the NFL. And he just took it out on anybody who got in his way, and then he took his own life, careful to preserve his brain. He said in the note that he wants his brain to be studied. I mean, it's tragically sad that he went through this torturous kind of experience and then used it to, takes it out on innocent people.
Yeah, and the idea that we can combat this with additional force is just ridiculous. And I really want to caution folks against also sort of lumping all people who struggle with mental health issues in the same bucket when talking about this issue, because that also often happens and it draws attention away from some of the other root causes that are going on here. And I don't know if they described the shooter in terms of ethnicity or other background characteristics, but it is notable.
I haven't seen it yet. It doesn't mean that they... Because there's obviously still very active reporting happening.
Yeah.
The note was found this morning, et cetera. But yeah, I haven't seen it.
But it's important to note that, right, like he had... he's male. That's a really strong correlating metric in these incidents. But another thing to point out is that he had a license in Nevada, which I did not realize. Mm-hmm. And some listeners might remember that my nephew is a surviving victim of the Oxford, Michigan school shooting. And similarly, that firearm that was used in that attack was purchased at a licensed firearms dealer. It was not a lawful purchase. There's a lawsuit that's pending about that. But it was a licensed firearms dealer, and the ATF is not properly staffed to regulate those who sell weapons of mass destruction in the United States.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Panel at WAMC.org. I am live on air checking now to see if we have any email to read before the news break.
You know, it seems, Sarah, like we talk about the shootings on the roundtable too often.
Far too often.
And many of the things that we say, we repeat. They're powerful statements, and I just wonder if anyone's listening.
We do have an email from Zach who says, "This country has become absurd. This was only one of several mass shootings in the last 48 hours, one in Reno, another in Ohio, and this one in New York. This was the only story on the news last night, I believe, because of the sensationalism of an officer dying. May he rest in peace. But there are innocent civilians who did not sign up to protect others being shot every day in America. We need to address violence in this country, starting with these weapons. Like Neil Young said, how many more?" And that's from Zach, which is supporting essentially what you just said, Mike.
Yeah, what can you say that adds to the conversation? It New York does better than other states, and it's not good here.
Well, it really speaks to why federal laws are necessary at this point. I mean, enforcement of federal laws, but also enactment. There are very, I don't want to say easy, but smart gun reforms that are extremely popular across the entire United States of America that continue to be blocked in Congress by gun-toting MAGA Republicans who, the machinations behind them in terms of the gun retailers, really.
Manufacturers.
And manufacturers, right, who are profiting off of what's happening in our country right now on a daily basis.
Panel at WAMC.org. It is time now for a news break from the BBC. Our panel this morning, Bill Hammond, Sarah Rogerson, and Mike Spain. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue, and we will return after this.
We share. I got it from Agnes. She got it from Jim. We all agree it must have been Louise who gave it to him. Now she got it from Harry, who got it from Marie. And everybody knows that Marie got it from me. Giles got it from Daphne.
Welcome back to the Roundtable. The music this morning, the late Tom Lehrer, satirist from the 50s and 60s, died over the weekend at the age of 97. The playlist is posted online at WAMC.org. Our panel this morning, Bill Hammond, Sarah Rogerson, and Mike Spain. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org. The DHS is urging DACA recipients to self-deport. This coverage from NPR. The Trump administration is shifting its tone on how it handles immigrants brought to the U.S. as children under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA. In recent months, the administration has tried to strip 525,000 DACA recipients, also known as Dreamers, of benefits, although no regulatory changes have been made to end the program. The Health and Human Services Department said it would make DACA recipients ineligible for the federal healthcare marketplace in June, that was last month. Then last week, the Education Department said it was looking into 5 universities that offer financial help for DACA recipients. Also, immigration enforcement officers have arrested and detained DACA recipients throughout the country, which immigrant advocates said weakens protections of this group. The call for self-deportation sends another mixed message in the administration's immigration enforcement policy. At the start of the 2024 presidential campaign, now White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller said President Trump would end the program. After winning the election, Trump said he wanted the DACA recipients to stay. Sarah.
Yeah, so just to remind everyone what where DACA came from, it's an Obama-era policy, and it really illustrates the problem of regulating immigration by executive fiat. I remember it was 2011, 2012, and I was talking to a slew of news organizations, which always happens when any president issues any executive order regarding immigration. Mm-hmm. And I had very unpopular answers at the time for folks who were looking for some certainty. And I said, you know, this doesn't afford that. It doesn't afford a pathway to citizenship. It hands over your information to the federal government, whereas if you're undocumented, you might be able to live in this country without coming to the attention of federal authorities, and millions of people do every day. And it's not that it's a bad program. I just, you know, was already pretty cynical that it would outlive the Obama administration. Now, that being said, I was wrong about a couple of things. The courts have upheld DACA. The litigation around DACA spans multiple federal circuits. It's back and forth and up, and it takes a lot to sort of teach it. You could teach maybe 3 or 4 weeks of immigration law from the DACA cases that have gone up and down. So really what this is doing, and of course anytime that Stephen Miller is involved, it's some sort of effort to scare people into leaving the country voluntarily in order to boost their numbers of deportation, which they apparently feel is really important for them in the midterm elections.
It seems, I guess, I don't feel like there are mixed messages. I feel like it's a pretty consistent message that they're hostile to immigrants of all types, even people who are naturalized citizens.
Correct.
Have come under some attack. And the, so yeah, they, I was a little surprised that this hadn't already come up. That, and in fact, if I'm not mistaken, there have been people who have DACA status who have been at least taken into custody, if not deported. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of consistent with all of that. But I do remember during the Obama administration, he came under pressure to use his executive authority to do something for this population. And he said, no, I can't do that. I used to teach constitutional law, and so I'm familiar with the separation of powers, and I can't do that. And then a few months later, he did do it. And so he was well aware that it was at least at a minimum a shaky foundation that he was building on, and that a future president could overturn it. Now, I guess if a future president wants to overturn it, as Trump, I believe, tried to do in his first term.
He did.
Right.
That was one of the first things he tried to do.
He has to go through the right procedures, and he failed to do that. And that's why DACA is still here. So
yeah, the Administrative Procedure Act, which is like really sometimes boring stuff.
No.
Yeah, truly. really saves the day in a lot of the things that the Trump administration tries to do, because it's all about the proper administration of government. I've got another thing to say about this, but I want to give you a chance.
I wanted to clarify, and Sarah, you're the expert in the room. I mean, these are people in their 20s and 30s who came here as children. Some as infants, and have grown up and known no other country. They're active members of their community. They've lived next to every other ethnic American, and except for this very precarious legal immigration status that hangs over them. They're just our neighbors. I mean, they surround us, and it just seems to be the term self-deport is such a I just find it so offensive. It's also the reason that they're opening that that alligator Alcatraz. They want the press to report about how it's mosquito infested, has no air conditioning, it's disgusting, and the toilets don't work, because they want to. That's just one of the ways they want to scare people into not wanting to come, or if they're here, to get out, because you're going to end up in one of these god-awful places without proper due process, and it's cruel and it's unusual and it's punishment, et cetera. Am I incorrect? Didn't Trump soften on DACA after he left office when he was seeking his new term, and then all of a sudden he just pulls his support and Stephen Miller reigns?
Yeah, well, that's sort of their playbook. And the DACA recipients in particular are a favored group of immigrants in this country from a public perception standpoint. And now the Dreamers, who have worked really hard to draw attention to this issue, have been very careful to be inclusive in their advocacy and not set themselves apart. We have a problem in this country. We have many problems in this country, but one big one is that we have manufactured the ideals and project ideals that we want to see in a person and projected them onto different classes of immigrants. The DACA dreamers, because many of them have been so successful in this country, tend to get a lot of favorable public opinion, which can be tricky politically to navigate when you're trying to target them. So that's one piece of that, potentially. It's also possible that Obama was working off of, well, it's probable he was working off of completely different political calculations, a very different we were a lot closer to comprehensive immigration reform under the Obama administration. There was a lot more bipartisan agreement around the issues of immigration generally, and it was pre-Trump. What President Trump has done in both of his administrations is lay all the burdens of the working class on the immigrant, repeatedly, over and over again, like a campaign slogan. It's even more successful than the Trump brand, is the idea that America is failing because of its immigrants, as opposed to America succeeding because of its immigrants. So there's so much always to unpack, because people move, and because no one who is in this country, aside from First Nations people, is here other than by operation of law as a citizen, not a single person. And so, again, aside from First Nations. There's a lot of really difficult realities wrapped up in immigration in America. They all come to a head due primarily to colonialism and forced migration.
The thing that surprised me, part of the reason the Trump's immigration message was successful is that there is broad public support for taking action to limit, first of all, to limit people crossing the border illegally, and also to remove people who cross the border illegally. It's a popular political position. But he hasn't started with the most unpopular groups. In fact, my perception has been, and maybe this is just partly the way it's been covered, he started with the most popular group. So some of the highest profile cases involved people who were here on student visas, and they were targeted because of an op-ed they wrote or a protest they went to. So they were here legally. They were, exercising First Amendment rights, which maybe, I don't know, technically they didn't have. But starting there instead of starting with convicted criminals, for example, or people who very recently crossed the border without any permission and have no case for asylum. Like that would be the group I would have expected them to start with. I guess it turns out, first of all, it's hard to find those people. There aren't that many of them. It's much easier to pull up in a Home Depot parking lot and just kind of pull people who have, you know, stereotypical features of immigrants. And also, I think there is part of this is a strategy to display ruthlessness, to display, like, we're not going to worry about the niceties of law and procedure. We're trying to scare people. And that does seem to be built into their strategy.
Let me hold you there, and we will come back right where we're leaving off after this underwriting break. You're listening to The Roundtable Panel.
With complete participation in that grand incineration, nearly 3 billion hunks of well-done steak. We will all fry together when we fry. We'll be French fried potatoes by and by.
Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel. Our music this morning, Tom Lehrer, the satirist from the 50s and 60s and mathematician. My sentence's structure just fell apart completely, and I apologize for that. But anyway, passed away, a legend of popular artist, and many listeners were fans of his, passed away at the age of 97 over the weekend. Sarah, you were going to respond to Bill Hammond's comments about immigration as we went to break.
Yeah, Bill was commenting on the ruthlessness of these tactics and the intent behind that. It's very, very clearly intentional, and something that echoes of another really ruthless and intentional Trump 1.0 era policy, the family separation policy, so-called. Where children and their parents were separated at the border and then detained in separate locations, and some of those children have not been returned to their families to this present day in spite of court orders ordering the federal government to do so because they can't find them. I heard another disturbing headline on your radio station as I was...
Our radio station.
I was speaking to the public.
Oh, sure, yeah. Right, great, perfect, sorry.
The royal you. That the Trump administration is targeting SNAP beneficiaries, not because immigrants are eligible for SNAP, because they're not, but because their United States citizen children are. So using the fact that people are feeding their children to find them and presumably arrest and detain them, thereby separating them from their children, many of whom are likely U.S. citizen children, is just another way that the Trump administration is sending a message. Not only should you be afraid, but you should be afraid to seek help of any kind, whether it be help with law enforcement, which is something that I've talked with Mayor Sheehan about, whether, you know, the challenges of... the challenge that this poses to legitimately deployed law enforcement agencies trying to protect the public. It's really difficult.
David,
to be
an
immigrant in America now.
Of course.
There's a similar thing going on with Medicaid, where they're apparently turning over Medicaid data on there's some back and forth on this. The AP's done a good job of trying to get to the bottom of it, but the border protection people have asked for access to the Medicaid files. They initially said it was to look for fraud
and waste,
and it turns out no, they just wanted the addresses to find people who are here who they could go after to deport. And that is, it's disturbing. Because, again, similar to SNAP being about feeding children, this is about getting health care. And you don't, it's very unusual in this country to use personal data like that for law enforcement. There's usually kind of a wall. And this is a fishing expedition. They're not even going there with a warrant. We need the records on this individual because we have probable cause. This is like let's see the records and we'll go through and see. You know, it's very open-ended, and it's appalling that that level of access would have been granted.
One of the things that folks don't realize, too, is that you don't actually, that the legal standard for, quote-unquote, investigating immigrants is lower. It's reasonable suspicion. So that it's yeah, there's
the, but the records, the Medicaid records they're looking at aren't even, like, most of them are citizens. Like,
yeah.
They're sort of pawing through the records of innocent people who may or may not be immigrants at all. And yeah.
And there's another element to that, too, just as an aside. It's the transfer of huge amounts of confidential data, what had been protected data, Social Security data, data from Medicare, Medicaid, data from other databases, SNAP recipients, et cetera. And it's getting moved around. That's going to get hacked. It's going to get out there. It just violates personal rights of people to have confidentiality for such sensitive parts of their lives.
Yeah.
And last week, I don't know if Stephen Miller even looks at polls, but I mean, Gallup poll showed that 62% of Americans were opposed now to the current immigration policies. They liked, as you were saying, Bill, they liked the idea of making the borders harder to get across, and people who come over and keep getting sent back and coming over and sending them back to their native country or out of the U.S. in any way. And they certainly, anybody with a violent crime past in their country or here while they're here as an immigrant. And, you know, people wanted to see those people get deported, but now that was the low-hanging fruit. I mean, it's everybody else now, it's not what they want. I mean, the New York Times did a story about a town in Oregon where a local family headed by an immigrant who was not documented, but they've been there for 30 years and he ran a business. He's been put into a detention camp and will be deported most likely to Mexico. And the whole town, which is a red town, it's in a rural part of Oregon, is very much in favor of MEGA and everything, and they were right on with Trump. And now suddenly they're saying, but what happened here? We didn't mean that. That's not what it is. And this is a realization happening right and left across our country.
Yep. I've heard from a
lot. Right and right.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, it's true.
Very well put.
I've heard that.
Right and wrong, actually.
The most often that I hear from people who self-identify as Trump supporters is when someone that they care about is targeted by immigration authorities. So just anecdotally, that totally tracks. And what's ironic about all of this, I don't know if this is the right use of the term ironic, but, you know, Obama deported way more people than Trump has. And I think that bothers him. And what's wild is if he just followed the Obama era, I'm not suggesting this was a good idea, but followed, it would be better than what we have now, the Obama era policy of going strategically, focusing on people who are already in the criminal justice system, then he would probably be able to report more success to his followers against less popular groups, which again is also not great because our justice system is so broken and skewed. But, you know, at least, you know, if they wanted to get the job done, they probably should have done it more like Obama, actually.
Sarah, am I remembering this correct? Didn't a few weeks ago Trump come out under pressure and say, well, we're not going to have hotel workers who are undocumented and farm workers who are undocumented and maybe meat processing plant mm-hmm. workers who aren't documented. We're not going to go after them. We're going to stay away from them. And then it backfired on him and he had to pull it back or something like that.
I don't remember that, but it wouldn't surprise me
yeah.
because those are traditionally industries that rely on migrant labor of all kinds, formal and informal. So also the care industry. So there's just that he's undermining. You're right. Your points about privacy are so right on. That it's maybe it's time for Americans to realize that it's all of our privacy that's being undermined. It's all of the fabric that holds all of us together when we target immigrants. It doesn't. These policies don't just affect them. It impacts us as well.
David sent an email to panel at WAMC.org and says, panel, every person within the U.S. borders has First Amendment rights. Let us not help, quote, them out and make that a question. Furthermore, though it seems to have little influence on the United States behavior, freedom of speech is a human right. Give no quarter on this in your commentary, please. And Ellen wrote in and said, in addition to all of the excellent points made, it's a terrible financial decision to deport DACA immigrants. Every local school district has spent a minimum of $100,000 to educate these young people. They're probably more appreciative of being in the United States than many of us who were born here. And that is from Ellen. Letitia writes in and says, when I read the story about DACA recipients being encouraged to self-deport, I am both sickened and wonder what is next. We haven't hit bottom yet. Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Our panelists this morning, Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy, Bill Hammond, Albany Law School Professor and Director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson, and former Times Union Associate Editor, Mike Spain. We will return with more of the roundtable panel after this.
Did you ever take a hike?
No, I didn't.
Well, how'd you like to ride my bike?
Frankly, I wouldn't.
Isn't, couldn't, didn't, wouldn't. Is that all you can say?
Isn't, couldn't, didn't, wouldn't. Yes, now go away. The sweetest sound to me. It stands for not. I like it a lot. It's spelled N apostrophe.
Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LeDuc here with Bill Hammond, Sarah Rogerson, and Mike Spain. The music this morning from the late Tom Lehrer, the satirist and mathematician, passed away over the weekend. He was 97. Judy wrote in to panel at WAMC.org and says, thank you for acknowledging the sly wit and genius of Tom Lehrer. My husband and I are longtime listeners since the beginning and members of WAMC. When we met, we found out we both loved Tom Lehrer and each had his songbook. Then we got married. 34 years now, and Tom Lehrer remains one of our favorites. The song Pollution is still current, and so are many of the war songs. The others are just wonderful fun, and that's from Judy. Thank you, Judy, for sharing your memories. Someone also wrote and said that Tom Lehrer put all of his music in the public domain in sometime this century, in the 2000s of some kind. So that's interesting, too. Just, you know, he's like, I don't even need the whatever.
Sounds like a really fun wedding, too.
It does. It does.
I do.
Standing around all dudded up, just listing elements and having a wonderful time. Again, thank you for sharing your memories of Tom Lehrer. We are celebrating the satirist this morning. He died over the weekend. Let us now discuss redrawing maps. This from the New York Times. If Texas lawmakers follow through on President Trump's plan to redraw state congressional maps to help the Republican Party, New York leaders say they want to be ready to respond in kind. Democrats in the state assembly and Senate will introduce a bill today that would allow New York to redraw its own congressional lines mid-decade instead of every 10 years linked to the U.S. Census if another state does so first. Governor Greg Abbott of Texas has cited constitutional concerns in his call for Texas to draw new lines, but the actual motive seems political. Mr. Trump has suggested that Texas's redistricting could help Republicans gain 5 House seats in their mission to keep control of the chamber after the 2026 midterms. Currently, Republicans have a 7-seat edge in the House with 4 seats vacant. To make Mr. Trump's desire a reality, Republican state lawmakers have begun a special legislative session and public hearings on redistricting are underway. New York's response is the latest counterattack from Democratic-led states and organizations. The main super PAC supporting House Democrats has seeded a new fund with about $20 million to go after congressional Republicans in Texas if the state's legislators follow through on the redistricting effort. In New York, Governor Kathy Hochul said the state would follow its rules, but added that all's fair in love and war. Bill.
So this is a saga I've been following for a lot of years. After the 2010 census, mm-hmm. there was a lot of pressure on the legislature to not gerrymander. There was even like a Ed Koch, the former mayor of New York City, founded a group that tried to pressure people to sign a pledge not to gerrymander. One of the people who signed that pledge was Cuomo. In the end, the legislature gave him gerrymandered maps, and he signed them, but he signed them with the commitment from the legislature that they would amend the Constitution. This required a bipartisan commission. The very first time, everybody thought that that amendment was an excuse for doing the wrong thing, and it wasn't workable. The very first time they had to implement it, which was just a couple years ago, it turned out not to be workable. The bipartisan commission couldn't agree on maps. The legislature passed their own maps, which gerrymandered. The courts threw them out. Like, it was a classic mess. And now they're saying, let's do that again. it's doomed to fail. If they put that in front of the voters, I think the voters will say no. If they try to override the Constitution again, the courts are going to say no. We just don't have the environment here where this kind of thing is possible. And I have to say I'm thankful for that. Like, I'm thankful that we have a competitive set of elections for Congress. That's what we should all want. We shouldn't want the legislature sort of manipulating things to get a desired outcome. And by the way, they're framing it as this is about, you know, fighting back against MAGA Republicans. But a lot of it is just about protecting incumbents. They're, you know, the person leading the drive for this is Hakeem Jeffries, the minority leader of the House. He wants to protect his members who are Democrats. And that's what mostly redistricting has been about in New York traditionally, is protecting incumbents. And I think this is a continuation of that.
It'll be interesting to see what they find when they start digging into the demographics in Texas as well. Texas is a state that has seen a massive shift, a lot of migration from inside the United States, and a lot of different, a lot of diversity of opinion has moved into Texas over the last decade plus. I used to live there. I practiced immigration law in Dallas, Texas, under the Bush administration. And that was around the first Obama election, the national one. So I was pretty active in politics, Democratic politics in Dallas, and specifically with the presidential campaign. And it was really interesting. You all remember that Obama won that race nationwide by securing really legally obtained detailed information and then putting together a field ops plan that really got people registered to vote and then turned out the vote in a targeted way. And so I just remember looking at reams and reams and reams of paper and all of these different shifting landscapes. And there was a lot of talk. There has been a lot of talk since about how maybe purplish some parts of Texas are and then straight up blue in some areas. So it's interesting that Texas is the state that they're choosing to fight this fight. And as you're saying, it's interesting that New York is the one that's posting up first. I don't know if that's wise, but maybe I'm not saying that the data won't be misused, but it will be interesting to see what happens when they start digging into who lives where in Texas.
So I'm not sure about the technical answer to this question, but wouldn't they be using the 2020 census data to do the reach? Like, because it's a decennial census, I think the redistricting has to, at least in New York, it has to be based on the decennial census. I don't, maybe Texas has a different system.
Yeah, I don't remember. But, you know, the migration to Texas has been happening over the last 20 years. So
I looked this up. Texas gained, I think it's 2 million something people since 2020.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
That's the most any state has gained. New York lost something like 300,000 people since 2020, the most any state has lost. So if you want to talk about strategy and gaining power in the House of Representatives, being the biggest population losing state is the wrong way to go. We're going to lose at least, I would predict, at least one seat, maybe two, in the next reapportionment. So whether they're all Democrats or whether they're a mix of Republicans and Democrats, we're going to be down two. Mm-hmm. And Texas is going to be up several. And like I think the leaders should be, instead of playing games with reapportionment, I think they should be focused on that. Like, what is it about New York that's driving people away? And a lot of them are going to places like Texas and Florida. Is it because they like the, you know, the unbearable heat?
I wonder why.
We've got that here now.
Oh, right.
Well, and Texas is vast. I'll bet people aren't moving into Houston. That's where it's really bad. But
heat-wise,
heat-wise, and the heat and the humidity. Mm. But they are. I mean, I think it's industry. At least it was when I was living there, because there were a lot of industries that were choosing Texas as their home base, and then people would move for jobs.
Yeah, I mean, isn't part of the strategy of Texas is to have less regulation on industry, attracting industry, tax breaks, et cetera, and maybe regulation, fewer regulations. But the notion that Texas, it's an interesting notion, that the state of Lyndon Baines Johnson might once again be blue, I can't even imagine it. It's hard to think of it, but you make a case that it's turning purplish, which is it's very interesting to see. And I think that's what Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas, is, and the Republican leaders are worried about. They need to tamp down these demographic changes so that they don't end up having more Democrats, more than the few Democrats that represent Texas in different congressional districts come to Washington. Now, out of 26 congressional seats in New York, only 7 are Republican. So it's kind of the same ratio, I think. You know, it's pretty firmly we're a blue state. And something tells me that you know, that's already the result of somebody's gerrymandering over the years.
Well, because the state was kind of, the legislature was kind of ham-handed, it was challenged, and the congressional lines had to be rewritten by a court master.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
And so the congressional lines, they were slightly modified by the legislature after that, but they're basically a clean set of lines. They weren't, you know, like there was not a lot of gerrymandering in our congressional races. So you ended up with more competitive elections, and the ratio of, what is it, 18-7 is what came out of a competitive process. Mm.
Well, the other aspect of this story that got me was the quote by Governor Hochul, "All's fair in love and war," you know. I mean, that's, it seems now to be a race to the bottom. Who can be more, you know, they're doing this, so we're going to do that. They're doing this, we're going to do that. And it just, you fight fire with fire and burn the place down. California, evidently, is also considering making changes, because probably a lot of the same dynamic that's going on in Texas is going on in reverse in California. I mean, they're getting people from different places who tend to be more not as avid Democrat leaning, you know, and you know, it everybody is trying to hold down the fort and keep their seats. What's wrong with candidates appealing across party lines and trying to bring in people from both areas to support them in a more moderate way?
But that's not the time we're living in.
That's a crazy idea. You know,
it's like futurism. But when talking about Texas and the idea of it ever being purple or blue-ish, it's a big you know, Ann Richards is a huge Democratic hero in Texas. And I think that it wasn't that long ago. It was the mid-90s, and she was the second female governor in the state of Texas. We've only just had our first here in New York. And that happened very recently. But, you know, I think that that Texas is way more complicated politically than people often give it credit for. And I'm curious to know how the erosion of Trump's base is going to play into, in terms of the Epstein thing and all of that, how that's going to play, because that creates sort of an unpredictableness to the redistricting, because you can't assume that people who voted consistently for Trump will do so again for another election. And especially where there are high concentrations of MAGA Republicans. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out in this calculus.
Mark writes in to panel at WAMC.org and says, Napoleon thought Russia was his. Democrats think Texas is theirs. Hope springs eternal. With tongue in cheek, I believe.
It's interesting to hear that Ann Richards' memory is still fresh in Texans' minds.
Well, Democrats anyway.
I think a lot of the idea that Texas is turning purple is based on the idea that it's having an influx of immigrants and an assumption by Democrats that immigrants are going to break their way. And I think that assumption has been
disproven.
Been undermined.
Yeah.
Definitely. I don't know if it's
in
been
Florida.
Fully disproven, but it's been undermined
yes.
in
yeah.
places like Texas and California and Florida. So I'm not sure, like, I mean, the answer to New York's problem is to try to figure out what it is about the Texas formula that we can adopt here. But we'll see.
Matt writes in and says, I believe the only way to speak to the possibly reasonable among the discontents and malcontents who are currently swayed by those in power is to recognize systemic corruption and actually advocate for fundamental fair reform that would take a bite out of both Republican and Democratic Party decadence, control, and dishonesty. You see, even in current polling, that regular people who did vote for Trump are becoming unsettled, but they still may not agree with Democrats. We need fundamental fairness on top of which to advocate our greater policies. I wish the response to redistricting and other forms of corruption was not more corruption from the other side. And that was from Matt. Mm-hmm. And Jay writes in and says, regarding fighting fire with fire, so do you suggest they don't just fight at all? Like what methods would you tell New York to do to help fight the fight that MAGA is fighting?
No, that's a good point. I mean, if MAGA is using dastardly tricks to take down the Democrats and weaken the Democrats, how can they not fight back? Of course. But, I mean, do you always have to take the low road? You can take the high road, and like Bill was talking, you know, you could bolster the system that we have and recognize that maybe if politicians and parties recognized that, you know, that when you do the numbers, seven districts lean red and the other 26 or the other 18 congressional seats in New York lean blue, politicians across, I mean, this happens. It happens all over New York. It happens everywhere. Politicians learn how to appeal to more than just the blue voters or the red voters, and that is their success. I mean, Mike Lawler appealed to a lot of moderate people to get elected, and so did Patrick Ryan in the Hudson Valley.
Yeah.
They couldn't. And I don't know. It wasn't that long ago that a congressional candidate named Kirsten Gillibrand was elected in the district that is pretty much now the very red district of Elise Stefanik. It was different borders, but it was very similar in its footprint. I mean, you know, it can happen that people can go across party lines and win bipartisan support. And as much as you got to fight fire with fire. I don't disagree with that. And sometimes, you know, you got to use the courts. You got to use whatever system you can to block the other from doing something, especially if it's dastardly. You should also be doing the high road, which is maybe New York's blue Democrats need to just moderate.
You know, we could expand voting rights. We could make it easier for people to get to the polls. We could do a lot of other things besides try to mathematically and geographically reconfigure and separate people for the outcome that we think we want. I mean,
New York is actually, it has done some reforms recently, but it's New York is kind of retrograde in terms of, for a long time, it didn't allow early voting. It didn't allow, it made it hard to do absentee. It started to improve in that area, but I guess another thing, I want to point out is that gerrymandering does not explain Donald Trump. Like, Donald Trump did not run for Congress. He ran for president. Gerrymandering has no effect on the outcome of a presidential race. He won a clear majority. He won the Electoral College. Like, he was popular. It wasn't because of any manipulation of the system.
Well, his ability to govern and his ability to promulgate his policies,
that depends,
totally dependent on the outcome of congressional races, in which are affected greatly by gerrymandering. I mean, and that's why he's been calling up various Congress members and senators, representatives and senators who are considering running for local office or considering leaving office, and trying to convince them to run for reelection. He knows how thin the numbers are, and how if the midterms go against him, it's over for him. I mean, it'll just be 2 years of nothing.
What gerrymandering has done is it's contributed to the increased partisan polarization in Congress, so that the typical member is more concerned about a primary from their own party. So for the Republicans, a primary from the right, and for the Democrats, a primary from the left. So they're more concerned about appeasing the extremes of their party rather than working across the aisle.
Is that like the city of Albany, the way that works? Very similar.
You mean the legislature?
No, the city of Albany when they elect a mayor.
Oh, okay, maybe.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Panel at WAMC.org. Our panel this morning, Bill Hammond, Sarah Rogerson, and Mike Spain. A new story now about the food stamp info suit that is being filed against the Trump administration or President Trump. A coalition of states, including New York, announced plans yesterday to sue the Trump administration, seeking to block a federal agency from collecting personal information on food stamp recipients, including their Social Security numbers and immigration status. So we talked sort of around and near this in a previous topic this morning, but we will dive into this one for a few minutes here now. This coverage is from WNYC. States have until July 30th, so tomorrow, to send the U.S. Department of Agriculture data for all SNAP beneficiaries for the last 5 years, or else risk losing funding. It will be up to a judge whether to extend that deadline. California Attorney General Rob Bonta and officials from the 20 states and Washington, D.C. filed the suit in a U.S. district court in California. Bonta said that the suit argues the Trump administration's unprecedented request for personal data is an illegal data grab that violated federal privacy laws. New York Attorney General Letitia James said the request for data was an outrageous way to target immigrant families and boost the administration's deportation numbers. Sarah.
I agree with the Attorney General. And just to remind folks what SNAP benefits are used for, it's fruit, vegetables, meat, poultry, fish, dairy products, non-alcoholic beverages. It's pretty tightly defined and really focused on nutritious food, including seeds, which you can purchase and then grow your own food. So I think it's important to remind people that they're only, you know, one catastrophic event from needing to rely on these services. And it's really easy. Another thing that Trump is doing is blaming poor people for whatever the white men in this country are upset about. And so when you have the confluence of immigrants and poor people, which are not always the same, in spite of Trump's efforts to cast those things together, not that either of them are inherently bad in any way, but that's just sort of one of his drum beats here. It's that, you know, instead of taxing the rich, we really need to crack down on poor people.
Mike?
No, I think it goes back to the whole fear that you know, that the Trump administration and the people who control the levers of power will be able to just type up, you know, go through databases, use AI to find and identify potential people to deport. And I mean, isn't that really what it's about? It, as Bill mentioned earlier, ostensibly the reason they just want all this information because they want to make sure there's no waste or any fraud on the eligibility of SNAP recipients, you know, and that the states are handling that right. And that's not the issue. And it's an insult to people to suggest that that's the issue here, and that it is simply to misuse technology to violate people's personal privacy and go in and identify more people that Stephen Miller's troops can run out of the country and hit that goal of 1 million people in 2025 so Trump can have a press conference and say, I did it. All he wants is that headline. And, you know, even though all of the reporting afterwards will show you that how that's inaccurate and not the case and all the problems with it, he gets the headline. And that's what he wants.
And SNAP fraud is exceedingly rare, according to a congressional report from this past April.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Bill Hammond, Sarah Rogerson, and Mike Spain in studio as your roundtable panel this morning. Time now for a news update from the BBC.
What's the chance it will snow when you bet? And you end up in debt. Oh, try as you may, you just can't get away from mathematics.
Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. Our music this morning by the late Tom Lehrer, the satirist and mathematician, died over the weekend. He was 97. The playlist is posted online at wamc.org/roundtable. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org. Our panelists this morning, Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy, Bill Hammond, Albany Law School Professor and Director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson, and former Times Union Associate Editor, Mike Spain. This from the New York Times, the trade deal that we discussed on yesterday's show that was reached over the weekend between the United States and the European Union will impose a 15% tariff on imported medicines from Europe. Drug makers manufacture some of their biggest and best known blockbusters there, which I thought was an interesting word choice, blockbusting medications, including Botox, the cancer medication Keytruda, and the popular weight loss and diabetes treatment drug Ozempic. The tariff rate is much lower than the levies of up to 200% that President Trump had threatened. Still, the new import costs stand to add billions of dollars in expenses for the drug industry and could lead the price increases for some medicines. That could translate into higher out-of-pocket costs and higher health insurance premiums for American citizens. The 15% rate is final and will not be affected by the national security-related tariffs that Mr. Trump is expected to impose on pharmaceuticals made elsewhere in the world, according to a White House official and senior European Commission officials. Bill.
So maybe I'm missing something, but like that 15% applies to everything, right? Like it's not just on drugs. Okay. So, I mean, this is an example of why tariffs are a bad idea generally. They just add to the cost of everything. And one of the things they're going to add to the cost of is drugs. And these are like necessary things. These aren't luxury goods by and large. I guess you could maybe argue that Ozempic is a luxury good to the extent that people are using it just for weight loss.
Depends on the prescription and
or Botox.
But there is a medical need for Botox for people who have a chronic headache sometimes.
Yeah.
So, this is medicine. Like, the whole idea of medicine is that it's important to keep you well. And so it's unfortunate and counterproductive when we tax those things. And that's what a tariff is.
Mike?
Yeah, I was surprised to learn in this story, because it had more detail than I had understood, that there's some suggestion that the pharmaceutical companies make such enormous profits, mm-hmm. they might just eat it, basically, and they might not pass along all of the 15% that they're being hit with. But
wouldn't that be something?
Yeah, I mean, that would be... And they'd still make gazillion dollars,
sure,
you know,
and, of course.
And maybe that would happen. And certainly Trump has argued that he hasn't argued that, but he's argued that the consumer may not have to pay it. But what I did also note was, there's so many drugs that are generic, so many just maintenance drugs that are formerly branded drugs that now are just, they cost pennies. Compared, like statins and things like that, that are just parts of people's regular medical, routine to stay healthy. And those drugs do not have a high profit margin. So those are the drugs that will definitely be affected by this. And the other aspect of this is the details are not really out yet. There could be all kinds of little carve-outs. And I think Trump was trying like crazy to announce and have that, and have that photo op shaking hands with the head of the EU, wanted to announce it before August 1st because he didn't want to have another deadline go by where he didn't have tariff agreements. And this gave him that opportunity. But really, it's a lot of details have to be worked out. A lot of negotiation is continuing. Some European leaders are even unaware of things that he claims are in there, and it isn't a done deal as much as it's portrayed that way. And maybe there'll be some carve out for medically necessary products like drugs and devices that are manufactured all over the globe.
Sarah?
I had no idea that pharmaceuticals were Europe's number one export to the United States.
Right.
So
I didn't either.
Big drug users.
Well, and they're big drug producers, it turns out. But, it sounds like Trump is looking at industries that are succeeding abroad and using tariffs to try to force manufacturing to happen stateside. But it's the industries themselves that are being targeted. They're saying, no, that's a terrible idea, right? So the pharmaceutical industry has said, that's just not how this works. And so I wonder if this is going to be, what do we call it, taco? Trump
right.
always...
Chickens out.
Chickens out. Yeah, I think he was avoiding taco.
Yeah, so this might be one of those... areas where he really thought he had a great idea, and there's a lot of money in pharmaceuticals that can fund campaigns as well, and it's not really working out the way that he thought it would. But they're permanent. Is it permanent? Permanent? What does that mean? Permanent? Aren't they permanent until he says they're not?
I mean, they're permanent, and he's doing all of this by executive action. And I think there's some question as to whether he has the legal authority to do some of this. And it's undoubtedly being challenged in court all over the place. There's also the possibility that Congress will overrule it. And then the next president is free to overrule these things. So they're only permanent as long as...
courts don't enjoin them.
I mean, in the first instance, his whim... He can withdraw them at any time.
Doesn't he need a premise, though, that it has to be for national security reasons or that we're being attacked by another country?
He's acting under, I think, a couple different laws, and they do require some premise, but that hasn't been litigated sufficiently to constrain him. Like, either there's not enough court precedent to establish what the limits are of his authority, or there's an active case right now that's challenging his authority. So the thing is, among other things, he's creating all kinds of uncertainty for the reasons we've just discussed, right? If you're a pharmaceutical company, first, I'm not sure 15% would be enough to really force your hand to onshore your manufacturing to avoid a 15% tariff. But you have no reason to think that 15% tariff is going to last more than a couple more years. And why would you go to the expense of onshoring your manufacturing if there's a...
Could it even be accomplished within a couple of years?
Right.
Well, and if you can't even get your experts visas to get into the country to lead these operations, and you're deporting all of the other students who are promising... at Harvard or elsewhere, Columbia, who might fill those industries, then you're putting yourself in a catch-22.
Yeah, and many of the way it has worked, as I understand it, and I kind of remember even from the COVID development of the COVID vaccines, which was a little different because it was so rapidly done, but it was that scientists in the U.S. Might develop. And test and come up with and get approved for certain drugs, but the system is that they go elsewhere to have them manufactured because it's like computer chips would all go to Taiwan. I mean, it's that these hubs have developed around the globe. India is a big hub, and then Europe, of course, is gigantic. Ireland, I guess, is a big one too, specifically in Europe. Where there's companies that can contract to deliver your specific drug that now has been approved by the FDA and may also be approved by the European Union and elsewhere. And so the product might be developed here, but it just doesn't make immediate sense to try and produce it here because you have the entire infrastructure for producing it. In place. And you're right, Bill. I don't think 15% is of maybe a couple more years is going to be enough to motivate companies to invest gazillions of dollars needed. And then it will cost more to produce them here after the fact. I mean, that's partly the problem. So the intellectual development is here and the manufacturing is elsewhere. That's a model that's worked in a lot of different ways that is being interrupted here. And I don't see it coming back to that. It's problematic.
Jay writes into panel at WAMC.org saying, so I don't understand why or how tariffs are or would are helping us or would be helping us. What are my taxes going to pay for? So there's a sort of backing up question to clarify. What's the claim? How could these be helping citizens or the country?
I read a piece just because of that same question, like what are tariffs supposed to do? And one of the news services, I think the Washington Post, did a bulleted thing. They're kind of supposed to do three things. They're supposed to raise revenue for the government. I mean, if a company is hit with a 15% tariff, they have to pay 15% on whatever goods come into the U.S. that are covered by the tariff. So the U.S. And they pay it to the U.S. Treasury. And then what happens to the price to the consumer depends on who is able to absorb some of that or not, or whether it all goes right to the consumer or whatever. And then the other is that it's supposed to promote, as we're talking about the pharmaceutical industry and maybe a lot of other kinds of industries, it's to make it an inducement for the U.S. to produce those goods here because they you know, because we can produce them cheaper now because there won't be a 15% tariff if we produce it in Iowa or North Carolina or someplace. But it still may cost a lot more to produce them here. I mean, making an iPhone in the U.S. is, what, 15 times more costly than making them in perhaps Taiwan or China or India where they're manufactured. And so it's a premise that it's supposed to help our industry grow, and it's also supposed to pay. Trump portrayed his tariffs as the way to reap enough revenue in the Treasury that we won't need an income tax anymore.
Yeah, it's kind of a self-defeating premise there, though, because if your goal is to discourage imports and encourage, you know, protect manufacturing here, right? Well, if that succeeds, imports are going to go down, tariff revenue will go down. Like if right. you're, it's sort of yeah. like the taxes we put on alcohol, like if and marijuana and all, and like sin taxes, they call them. If they're meant to discourage use of those products, and yet the government sort of looks at them as a source of revenue because they know people are going to smoke, they know people are going to drink, and they're going to gamble, and that's going to bring in money. It's to the extent Trump is counting on tariffs to bring in lots of money, he's basically assuming that the imports will continue and we're just going to pay the higher prices, which is going to the higher prices, in effect, are paying the tariff. So it's a tax on us. It's technically not a tax. It's a tax on the importer, but it ends up being a tax on us because the importer passes it along.
Never mind if manufacturing moves to the interior of the United States or production manufacturing, then there's more competition for the same amount of stuff within the United States. So the price of everything goes up because we don't have enough stuff, which is, well, we have plenty of stuff, but we don't have enough of the materials that we need to make everything that we use. And that's right. why we have a global economy.
I remember, I think in fifth grade or junior high in American history class, they talked about back in the early 1800s where you could buy a pitchfork made in England in the United States for, you know, 50 cents. Or maybe even less. And the ones that were made in the United States because they were starting up and they didn't have the level of infrastructure were 75 cents. So the government put a tax on pitchforks. And what it did was it made it the same cost to get an American-made pitchfork versus a European-made pitchfork. And as a result, pitchforks grew in the U.S. and then after a while it was a thriving business, and then it didn't matter whether there was a tariff or not. And that's the schoolhouse rock version of tariffs, but it's temporary, as you're saying, Bill. It's not a permanent solution to anything.
Our panel this morning, Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy, Bill Hammond, Albany Law School Professor and Director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson, former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain. The panel will be posted on our website, wamc.org/roundtable, a little bit after 11. Associate Producer Madeline Reynolds handles that perfectly and right on time, so it'll be online and available to stream. You are listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.